cooking up and puking something.
It keeps on quitting.
Well, maybe that's...
It's, the first time I'd actually tried connecting my computer to this screen, when I tried to use the other
what?
The thing that is supposed to
switch
the slides also.
No.
The other,
that's not really a problem.
Let me try.
Just 16
volts.
If it fits now, it's the display. It doesn't, my trick for getting it to flip displays was too much of a trick. Putting this on this side. So, the easy way is just actually
to
it'd be really hard to go through it.
Yeah, you might as well just kind of take the time to flip the displays.
Right.
That worked.
Hello? Okay,
the editor
key's working.
So, how do I get this?
Anybody want to bring this up?
Yeah.
Press on. Hello. Good, now I forget my talk. When I started my PhD in Santa Barbara, this was the title of the thesis, Gravitation at Astrophysical Distances. And I was looking at various problems, and when I met John Moffitt, I had to insert a new concept into the thesis, which was to add the normalization of gravitation at astrophysical distances. And to connect basically what we're observing in various experiments, this is the poster child of dark matter, the Bullitt cluster. It's the largest cluster in space we've ever detected. This is a NASA image. It's a false color reconstruction. The pink is the X-ray gas we actually see. It's about 150 million degrees Kelvin, the hottest spot in the sky. The purple on the outside is a reconstruction due to a combination of weak and strong gravitational lensing. So it is not optical data. Well, actually, it is optical data, but it's lensing data, and the gravitational information is reconstructed. However, the reconstruction will depend on your theory of gravity you use. So, space bar works too. So there's a need to connect their theory and experiment, and that's what physicists do. So what I'm going to introduce here is a theory of gravity called the non-symmetric gravitation theory. And I'm going to reduce it through a weak field limit and form a modified gravity. So basically, just like GR has Newton's theory as a weak field limit, the NGT will also have a weak field limit. And since it doesn't quite look like Newton's theory, it became known as a modified gravity. So here's basically the outline of what I'm going to present today. I'll very quickly point to the relativistic generalization known as NGT, which is actually a generalization of Einstein's theory. Then I'll take the weak field to form the modified gravity. I'll introduce the notion of RG float, which is how we're going to connect to experiment through the renormalized gravitational coupling, otherwise known as Newton's constant. We don't call it Newton's constant because it's not constant. Sometimes we call it Newton's coupling, but no one likes that. So it became known as the gravitational coupling. And since it really is a quantum field theory, when you have the gravitational sector, you like to see a coupling constant. And I'll even show you some mass terms related to the gravitational sector as well. On the experimental side, I've got a lot of images to show. I've been looking at the dark matter paradigm now for 3 years. So I've studied every galaxy rotation curve ever measured, including the 54 in Ursa Major, which I actually had to redo from scratch because they repositioned Ursa Major from, it's a cluster of galaxies with 50 galaxies inside it, and they moved it from a distance of 15 megaparsecs to 18 megaparsecs after the initial data was collected. And so all of the rotation curves for Ursa Major were outdated before I got to it. And since they went into my first publication on this matter, now I have, I guess, the biggest catalog of galaxy rotation curves published. Gravitational lensing is a really interesting calculation because it's the first calculation that really requires a fundamental step away from Newton's theory, because when we have a renormalized gravitational coupling, it changes across space. And when you integrate across a spatial set to calculate gravitational lensing, the Newton's constant is inside the integral. Cannot be pulled out. I've done 100 X-ray galaxy clusters. Actually, X-ray galaxy clusters were the first experiment ever done to show the existence of dark matter in 1932 or something by Zwicky. He measured the Coma cluster and postulated dark matter for that system. Then I'm going to bring things back to Earth and talk about terrestrial experiments, Cavendish-type experiments, why none of them exclude the NGT. They're all within experimental limits. As a matter of fact, when I did my master's degree with John Moffitt, my project was to look at Gravity Probe B and to make some new predictions for it. So we published my first paper in Physical Review D in 1991 on NGT in spinning test particles, gyroscopes, etc. And our prediction was that the measurement will be below the experimental uncertainty if they put the satellite around the Earth. But if they move the entire experiment to Jupiter, we would show a very slight deviation from GR. So today, I cannot think of any experiment to show the difference between NGT and GR in terrestrial experiments. However, once you get larger and larger scales, the effect becomes more pronounced. And by the time you get to one astronomical unit, you start to see a very tiny amount. By the time you get out to Jupiter and Saturn, like the Pioneer Anomaly, you actually start to see an effect. And I'll show that this might actually explain the Pioneer Anomaly. And then, of course, the big question is, can we explain the CMB structure formation, et cetera? So I've got a lot of pretty pictures to show. This first one is going to show the dark matter paradigm, the calculation I did in the bullet cluster. So that is the bullet cluster, and that's my calculation of the dark matter done inside this computer. NGT doesn't predict dark matter. So what do we predict instead? If you have a theory with dark matter is dominant, which means that you might be able to detect the gas underneath the dark matter. It would account for maybe 15 to 17%, but you will never see the galaxies in this picture. Due to dark matter dominance, dark matter, I can't say dark matter theorists, I can say astronomers who, basically the people who did the first bullet cluster analysis weren't able to see galaxies because using their theory of gravity, all they could detect was the picture on the right. With a modified gravity theory, you can actually detect completely distinct patches in the sky related to the galaxy distribution. And so as the lensing experiments become finer and finer resolution, this picture will actually become finer and finer resolution. And hopefully, those are the galaxies which we can see optically. Remember, these were reconstructed through lensing. So what I'm going to do with this next slide is I'm going to rotate this plane and show it to you in the third dimension. Okay, so it's going to be a surface plot. This is the same picture. So this is actually all the dark matter. This plot actually is the lensing data. So that's the dark matter. It looks like two giant mountains that have merged, and actually they're continuing to separate in space. The merger happened about 700 million years ago. And so the two mountains will fly farther and farther apart. In modified gravity, this is our fit. The black surface is due to the gas we see in X-rays. So it forms the substructure of the mountain on both sides. And then the red stuff is the matter just due to the galaxies. It's a very thin layer like grass on top of the mountain. And when you strip it off, you see that last picture, which is purely the galaxies. So dark matter illuminates nothing. Dark matter illuminates itself due to dominance. But once you have a theory, you can actually peer beneath and ask questions. So I guess I'll give you some basic details on what the theory is. Non-symmetric gravitation theory was written by Moffitt between the years of 1979 and 1995. It's been developed by Rob Mann and various graduate students throughout the years. What is the generalization of general relativity? So we're all comfortable working with SO31, the Lorentz group, which is where Einstein started for general relativity. And SO31 is not the largest symmetry group in four dimensions. The largest symmetry group in four dimensions is GL4. It's the general linear group in four dimensions. It's just a matrix with 16 elements. And so what Moffitt did was he embedded SO31 in GL4. And I'm going to show you a neat trick of algebra, which came later. And actually, that tilde is a star algebra. It doesn't exist in GR because Einstein used, well, I guess Einstein didn't start with the tetrad formalism, but nevertheless, when you work out GR, you can write GR exactly this way without the tilde. And so, basically, especially after Cole's talk, now what I can view NGT as is GR written in quaternions, because that tilde is actually a hypercomplex conjugation, and there's a mapping between the hypercomplex numbers and the quaternions. And so, yes, it's very similar to where you did quaternions, where you took all three complex dimensions and you put them into one. So I have the complex numbers where A equals X plus IZ, and hypercomplex, like that, I squared equals what? And here I have something very similar, except I have a slightly different symbol and a slightly different definition. Hence, we can see that the complex numbers are geometrically on a sphere, and hypercomplex numbers are on a hypersurface, hyperbola. Everything after that is the same as complex. So, So you can take the square root of this, right? But that just becomes a symbol. And so you can do the same thing here. But the details of this aren't relevant to my talk. So I don't want to spend too much time on that, especially since I've got a lot of matter to cover. But I'm going to use this tilde operation, essentially.
Transfers W to minus W.
Oh, yeah. Tilde is a star algebra.
But it's not just quaternions, it's just the...
There is a mapping between hypercomplex and quaternions. And actually, this could also be done in octonions. Right? But I don't want to get into that algebra. I do want to get into this decomposition, because the purpose of the tilde is to add back in the 6-ish degrees of freedom that were lost. And so here, on the left-hand side, I just have a full metric, right? It has a symmetric part, and it has an anti-symmetric part. And because it's a 4x4 matrix, it has a full 16 degrees of freedom. This means that there's existence of a non-symmetric component of the metric. Now, this upsets general relativists, because they don't need that. For one thing, it introduces torsion. So what we have is a spin connection with torsion. For those of you who are familiar with doing quantum gravity, we like to start with the triad or tetrad formalism, and we like to start with the connection. And so all the ingredients are here on this page to begin a quantization program of NGT along the lines of loop quantum gravity, except it's a richer theory. It has non-metric degrees of freedom, 6 of them, that are related to a field, which is a spin 1 skew-on. So the reason why relativists don't like this piece here is because it's unnecessary for the proper time. It just doesn't appear. And so it actually just doesn't appear. And so we still have a spin 2 graviton with 10 degrees of freedom, but we have 6 extra degrees of freedom in spin 1 skew-on. And so the particle spectrum isn't just a graviton. It's a graviton plus a skew-on. Let's erase that. I'm going to show the action. So that is the Einstein-Hilbert action. And I threw in matter on the right-hand side. If you want to work in vacuum, just set T mu equal to 0, and you get the vacuum Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay. So let's see what NGT looks like compared to Einstein-Hilbert. Well, I'm going to start with the exact same thing, except instead of using the affine connection, gamma, I'm going to substitute it for the NGT connection, which includes torsion, W.
So, so far, I have something that looks just like a generalization Einstein number. And frankly, if Moffat had stopped right there, I would have been very happy. Because the field equations would have been slightly richer, right? They would have included non-symmetric parts. But you wouldn't have had too many extra terms to carry along the way. But the Einstein-Hilbert extension wasn't enough. Moffat added a mass term for the spheron. And I just sort of rewrote the matter, and I'm just going to carry that down.
Joel, can I ask a quick question?
Sure, I'm just going to finish the page, and then I'll open up to questions. So, as I said, Moffat added more and more terms. Here's the other ones. Yeah, we've got a big action here, but nevertheless, it's an action, and we can work with it. So we have a term for compatibility of the connection. This is for stability issues, and I just rewrote the matter source. So I believe that is as big an action as we need to have a fully well-defined theory. Yes, Chuck?
This is what I never understood. Why is it this Q1 not just a normal spin-1 field?
This Q1 is a normal spin-1 field, just like the Graviton is a normal spin-2 field.
So then why is it not just the same as any other type of spin-1 field?
The only answer I can have for you is because this part of the action is where you put all the matter sources. And so there is a split into matter degrees of freedom and gravitational degrees of freedom. And so we know how to handle matter sources. We put them in there. And gravitational sources are everything else. And so the graviton does not appear in TNA, and the C1 does not appear in TNA.
So they are not matter sources. They are gravitational sources. They only appear to make the field equations consistent. Yep. Well, there's the Lagrangian, so you could actually decide that this was your gravitational sector and call this your matter source. But because the Einstein-Hilbert depends specifically on the connection and the full metric, all of those gravitational degrees of freedom appear in Einstein-Hilbert. And so by doing that reshuffling, you're definitely switching gravitational degrees of freedom into this side. However, they're already there. We already have a metric there. And so basically that becomes apples and oranges. You know, it's just two different interpretations of the exact same physics. Okay, so. Oh, yes, there's lots of coupling. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the skewon appears in so many places. It appears here. It appears naked here, but it also appears here. As a matter of fact, the skewon is everywhere, just like the metric is everywhere. It's simply because this can be decomposed into a symmetric and anti-symmetric part, so it's hard to have a clean split.
So presumably, you know, there are other objects which are built up from the metric. So, does this affect anything down the road? The fact that you're generalizing typical metric?
It does, in the sense that we use the metric for raising and lowering, and this is actually becomes a bimetric theory in the sense that the metric with fully covariant indices and the metric with fully contravariant indices become two different operators, and so you can lower indices in two different ways, and you can raise them in two different ways. And so the theory became known as a bimetric theory.
But in fact, you have to sort of make certain decisions in the beginning to do it all one way rather than switching halfway through your calculation. And so it turns out that there's two distinct choices for your beginning. And either you make a distinction on how to raise and how to lower operators.
And when you do that, once you make the choice, it's fully consistent either. And so the raising and lowering operations become well defined, but you have to define them. And basically, you're defining what you mean by a contravariant tensor, what you mean by a covariant tensor. Yep.
Referring to what Rob asked, I mean, if you were to put these skills on the right-hand side, well, into the team you knew, I mean, my comment would be then that you would have basically just a new dark matter theory.
Well, actually, just the way you said that, if you were to sweep this human to the right-hand side, there would be nothing left on the left-hand side, because there are no terms that appear without it. Okay, and so you can't separate what you're calling as dark matter from gravity. Ah, I missed a slide, and it was an important one, so I'm going to go back. Right. Go through this again. So I wanted to highlight what I'm going to actually use from this Lagrangian. So here we go, there's the full story. Okay, so what do I want to use from this, in the sense that I'm about to renormalize? So we've got a coupling constant here, mu. And we've got these fields, phi mu. Okay? And we're going to take the mass mu and this ion, these initial components, these are the actual x degrees of freedom. And when I do the weak field limit, I'm not going to take you through that calculation because it's an entire paper, but this is the punchline, that basically it's just a mapping between very complicated things on the left and a very simple parameterization on the right. And so that mapping basically is due to a weak field approximation, but it manifests something that's called the asymptotic freedom conjecture due to Weinberg, which says that
the asymptotic freedom conjecture for gravitation specifically applies towards the coupling constant in which strong renormalization effects occur at astrophysical distances. So just like in QCD, where you have quarks in which the coupling constant increases as you pull the quarks farther and farther apart, and in the case of QCD, the coupling constant grows to infinity so that quarks are confined to within nucleons. I'll show you a picture of the coupling constant in general relativity, and you'll see that it doesn't look like QCD in the sense that it doesn't rise up to infinity, it rises up to an asymptotic value. And you might be uncomfortable renormalizing Newton's constant, because in terrestrial experiments, it seems to be the same in every catfish experiment. And so you have to realize that you have to sort of approach astronomical scales to start to climb that curve. Okay. Right. Do I want to go through this? The infrared fixed point, I can deal with that on a one-on-one basis. However, this is actually the important one. This is the only equation I've numbered in this entire thing. So, as I said, we start with some gravitational degrees of freedom, a coupling constant. We do a weak field limit. This is basically the ratio of the actual gravitational coupling to Newton's constant, which we all know and love. It contains a mass scale and a length scale, which are derived through the theory. And basically, I have a function which looks like something which rises. And as you can see, it's you can study the exponential limits, right, as r grows large, as r grows small. And you can see how this function behaves. The odd part of this in terms of the function behavior is it contains data inside it. And so this is the only part of it that's data, that's the mass distribution. And so the functional form depends very specifically, not just on the particular values of m0 and r0, but specifically on the data. And so for galaxy rotation curves, we could fit every galaxy that was not a dwarf and not ultra-giant with the exact same m0 and r0. And so this data here was very important. So the rest of it, I mentioned M, that's just the total ordinary mass, the baryons we see, that's put into this equation. And M0 is just a mass scale, and R0 is just a range parameter. And so hopefully, as your systems get larger and larger, R0 should scale with the system, and M0 would scale with the system's mass energy. And I think I may even have a cumulative picture of all of that. So there's the equation once again, and now I'm going to show you the final answer. That's a plot of M0 and R0 for everything I've studied. So there's a total of 100 clusters, about, I'd say about 60 or 70 were normal size, and maybe 20 or 30 were dwarfs. I had about 50 galaxies and almost 50 dwarf galaxies. And the first thing I did was all the galaxies, and I got all of these wrong. I thought I had a universal parameter for M0 and R0, like Mond. That was a big mistake. So now everybody asks, why are M0 and R0 not universal parameters like Mond? And in fact, since they are derived through RG flow, you expect them to be scale parameters. So they should reflect the scale of the size. So if you take a look at M0, it's approximately 10 to the 12th solar masses, which is approximately the mass of a galaxy. R0 is approximately 14 kiloparsecs. The radius of the Milky Way, 20 kiloparsecs. So you can see that these scale parameters do reflect the scale of those systems. Dwarf galaxies, they didn't fit with the wrong parameters. And as a matter of fact, my predictions were ridiculous. The first galaxy I brought into John, I said, well, I have a very small galaxy. It's only 3 kiloparsecs across, but it weighs 10 to the 15 solar masses. And he said, great, this is exciting. We have a prediction. We're predicting a tiny little supermassive galaxy. And it really bothered me because it just didn't add up why you could have this tiny, tiny little dwarf galaxy, I realized later, with such a wrong value for the mass, especially because Mond gave such a nice answer for the mass. And so basically, I decided, well, these are much smaller things. I'm looking at scale parameters. And I didn't do a refit. I just changed R0 from this value to a factor of 2. And I changed M0 by a factor of 4 because I wanted M to go like R squared. So it was just a choice. And suddenly, my answers made sense, and Mond gave correct phenomenology. So I knew that the parameter flow should have put my dwarfs down here. Next paper came clusters. For clusters, I didn't have to guess at these values. I could fit the bulk properties to every cluster simultaneously and determine the value of M0 based on the visible data, the amount of gas I have. So we did a prescription, and it took out all the guesswork. And so this clump here is actually not quite correct. This is just the first attempt. Essentially, as I continue the study, these blue crosses are going to be moving to the left, and these blue crosses should be moving to the right, and it will fulfill this light blue curve, we're hoping. Now, hopefully you'll notice that there's something very odd in the behavior of the parameter space. There's something that looks like a phase transition. Okay? The phase transition is occurring. It's very sharp. And it occurs right at the point where I have no data because there's no cluster that's small enough. And there's no galaxy that's large enough to get points along that curve. So what does that mean? I'm seeing a phase transition in the data. Sorry, I'm seeing a phase transition in my analysis. We also see a phase transition in the universe. Okay? There is no explanation of why there's a point at which you don't see galaxies anymore, you start to see clusters. And so when these things are forming during structure formation, if you have a theory in which there's a natural prediction between two different regimes of behavior, where for systems smaller than 20 kiloparsecs, they would naturally form a galaxy. Because the renormalization sends you here. Your Newtonian gravitational constant is determined, and your forces are set such that galaxy dynamics are in place. If the system has a larger initial mass when structure formation occurs, you're naturally on this part of the curve, and the renormalization puts you on this curve, and it's clusters that form. And so this is a very nice thing. However, what we don't have is an analytic prediction for this blue curve. And at the moment, all I'm doing is studying the field equations in order to find out where this phase transition is going to emerge from. And it does look like it's coming directly from RG flow, because RG flow is used by condensed matter physicists for one reason only. They study phase transitions. they calculate critical constants, and they're able to determine whether that's a first or second order phase transition. It looks more like a continuous phase transition. And hopefully, we'll actually be able to connect theory to experiment and explain why galaxies are galaxies and why clusters are clusters. Questions?
So, back to version 1,
Moffitt derived that equation in one of his first papers on this. It comes directly from the weak field limit of NGT. So where does the RG flow come? It's not through the beta equation. It's more of, he forms a, I'm not really going to answer that question. Even if I try to answer it, it won't be as correct as it should be. So I'm going to have to talk to you after about it, about the actual derivation. Yes? Matt?
Yeah. You know, I thought there was another hand, but anyway. So, I mean, the only thing which I've heard about with your graph is that you're like looking at different objects, and you have the galaxies down there, and you have the clusters up there. And you say there's a phase transition in between.
Well, I have no data there, so I
you see those two bars and you say, well, something fancy must happen.
Well, I do have one other data point, but I haven't shown it yet.
But so kind of the thing which I'm only worried is that maybe kind of the theory behind it is screwed, and it applies only if you apply to different objects, you get completely different answers. So it's not something due to the physics of the object compared to your theory, rather than some actual phase transition going on.
Well, that's certainly a common statement. But that statement usually occurred in my first papers, when we just had a single value for M dot and R dot for all normal-sized galaxies. And then we had this bipolar paper where, for dwarf galaxies, we could not use those large values. We had to use smaller values. And so people say, yeah, you're having it all. You can fit all the galaxies, but you want to fit dwarf galaxies a different way. And so the vision that you have a universal constant has nothing to do with asymptotic freedom and RG flow. With RG flow, these are not M0 and R0. They're simply not universal parameters. You would expect them to be the same. You would expect them to flow. And so the requirement for this graph, hopefully, is that it's monotonically increasing. And that's really the only requirement that you're requiring. However, I can already visualize systems that I construct in the lab. I'm going to build galaxies in my mind, in which I build an extremely dense, compact galaxy. And just visualizing that, if I were to build a super dense, small galaxy, I want to put it at small r naught and large m. So I can build objects in my mind which are not on this curve. And so you can say, well, it's random. But in fact, it's not random, because there's a one-to-one correlation between r naught and the outer extent of the system, and a one-to-one correlation between m naught and the mass of the system. And so, in fact, all of these points are zero-parameter fits. I'm going to show you some of those fits now. And, of course, that's really where you judge the theory, based on how well it performs. So a caveat. We have to realize that when we look at experiments, terrestrial experiments, there is no Reggio-Newton's constant. However, in solar system measurements, including Cassini, we start to see some deviations around 10 AUs. I've already looked at the binary pulsar in 1991. Because the system has, well, I did a fit for that system in 1991, and just like my prediction for the gravity probe B, my calculation was that we have to watch the system for 7,000 years before we're going to see anything, simply because our prediction and GR's prediction are so similar. So at these scales, we know that Newton's law is universal. Question is, what about beyond these scales? In GR, when we solve for the Schwarzschild metric or any other metric, we force it to be asymptotically Newtonian. Okay. So Newton's constant does not emerge from Einstein's theory. This statement is very important.
astronomers do not understand that class statement. And when I present my talk to an astronomical audience, they do not understand why M0 and R0 are not universal functions. It's this last sentence which explains why M0 and R0 are not universal constants. It's because renormalization depends on the renormalization scale, the moment in which you do your experiment. And the renormalization tells you what value of this constant you're actually measuring. So let's go directly to some pictures and you can judge for yourself whether or not we're doing a good job. So Galois rotation occurs, you have the Newtonian acceleration as a 1 over r squared law. Basically, I use the exact same law, except I substitute Newton's constant with the actual renormalized value. And by substituting this in here, I can rewrite the actual acceleration as the Newtonian acceleration times this multiplicative factor. It's a dimensionless number because it's the actual Newtonian constant divided by a number, which is pretty much 1 plus an extra bit. So if you turn off all of this by setting r equal to 0 or m0 equal to 0 or r0 equal to infinity, then you get back Newton's theory, and any effect that would lead to dark matter would be gone. So what are we looking here? Basically, these two curves down here are the data. The purpley curve is the actual gas we see, the H1 gas plus the helium and the primordial ratio. The green curve is the amount of stars you see. And so a fit according to dark matter would mostly throw away all of that. And the actual fit due to the red data would basically be dark matter plus or minus a small amount of gas. And so you take a look at something like this kink, which is present in the data. It's present in the actual galaxy. And you can sort of say to yourself, well, this kink here is probably due to the actual baryons. So in dark matter, they say it's a coincidence. And the actual kink is simply due to the density of dark matter. And so before we got on the scene, this was a tremendous dispute between Mon and dark matter, where the Mon people felt that there was a strong correlation between the baryons and the rotation curve. And if you have dark matter, the correlation is tremendously reduced due to the dominance curve. Yes?
Small kink on top of the dark matter anyway.
In this particular galaxy, the mass fit in Mond or Mog is about 10 to 10 solar masses. When you do the same fit using dark matter, you need an order of magnitude more mass. But there's only so much gas that we detect. And so when you do the fit in dark matter, you determine at the end that the amount of visible matter is completely negligible.
Also, if there's radio?
Sure.
Also, if there's radio, because, I mean, most of the dark matter comes from the outer regions. And
right, so in the Newtonian core, it's definitely devoid of dark matter. And basically, you can sort of imagine it this way, that there's a halo. And as you extend from the center of the galaxy up, where you're traveling through space, which either the halo is very rarefied, or Newton's constant is Newton's constant, and then basically, as you start to approach a certain critical R0, my function turns on, the exponential starts to rise, and either dark matter starts to appear, or dynamically, you get the same effect due to monomer gravity. Either way, the point of this plot is that the cyan curve, the blue one, is Mond prediction. The black curve is Mog prediction, modified gravity prediction. And when this work first came out, there was no question to the Mond people if it was Mond or dark matter. So they knew that, in their minds, the answer was more closely related to Mond, which was designed to phenomenologically fit galaxies. And so the fact that the blue and the black curve are similar means that Mog and Mond provide equivalent phenomenology for galaxies. So let me show you what Newton's constant looks like to get that black curve. Okay. I think I've got an animation for that, because the galaxy is only 8 kiloparsecs across, so you can sort of see, just like the halo, there's very little dark matter towards the center, and then the amount of dark matter rises. In log, basically, this really is this function here. So basically, I'm just showing this green thing here as a plot. And now, I mentioned that it's asymptotic, so I'm going to pan out. I think I'm going to go up to 20 kiloparsecs. See if that animation actually worked. Okay, so right now we're just going to a larger and larger kiloparsec. I'm just reframing this function with a larger r. And so you can sort of see that it forms this nice plateau at large distances. And whenever g is constant in this range, you get back the order of r squared log. So at sufficient distances outside of the galaxy, you don't have this problem that Mond has, that you're forever on the flat rotation curve. So in Mond, you have a problem that when you're outside the galaxy, the forces are too large. But in modified gravity, simply because this function turns over, at this point, you're basically back to Kepler's law. Okay, so John was sent to Edinburgh to benchmark galaxy rotation curves. They provided for us four galaxies. And because I had already fit every galaxy ever measured, it wasn't really too much of a trouble. I already had them in my computer. And as a matter of fact, they already published. So they already knew that we did a good job. But they wanted to make a public press show out of it. And basically, they had Mond people, dark matter people, and John to represent the three different techniques for explaining the gravity in galaxies. And these were the four galaxies that they asked us to look at. So here's the results we sent to Edinburgh. And once again, it's the same kind of combination. We've got the comparison between the black and the blue. And of course, we added some data. So there's number one. These are all completely different. Two of them are dwarfs, two of them are normal size. Both theories are indistinguishable in terms of their fits. They both have extremely low chi squares. And they both provide excellent phenomenology. And the fact is that I looked at 100 galaxies and 106 galaxies, and 105 galaxies, Mog and Mond had equivalent phenomenology, indistinguishable. There was only one galaxy that Mond could not handle, and it was the smallest galaxy I have. Mog did a great fit to it, and I got a good mass. Unfortunately, Mond predicts an imaginary mass-to-life ratio for that small galaxy. And it's part of the problem with Mond that it's an excellent phenomenology, but it's designed to fit a very tight window. And so it will not fit any super, super small dwarf galaxy. You look at the map, you can sort of see exactly how that parameter goes in that shape. What about the very large systems? Well, I did look at 100 galaxy clusters. There's one of them. That's the Coma galaxy, the thing that started it all. So the red is the data. The black is Mog. They fit. This is a zero parameter fit. The constant m-naught and r-naught were determined by a bulk properties thing. And before I looked at Coma, I already knew what to use for m-naught and r-naught. So I had no choice. And there's the fit. And as a matter of fact, the system is modeled as an isothermal sphere. And it deviates from that behavior at very small r. And so you actually expect a wrong answer here. And once I actually include the correct thermal properties, this black curve will be forced downward. So actually, the fit is gorgeous. Let's take a look at Mond. Cyan is Mond. Fortunately, Mond does not fit any cluster. As I said, Mond is phenomenally designed in a very tight window. Not only is it an order of magnitude too large, just like dark matter makes no attempt to fit the data, right? There's simply as much dark matter as is necessary to disrupt that. But the Mond curve is supposed to match the data. Fortunately, it doesn't. Not only is it way too much mass, it's the wrong shape. And very often in physics, we do calculations where we want the integral to converge. That happens in Mond. Mond predicts a convergent mass to clusters. And when that was first discovered, Mond was put out as being a wonderful theory because it actually predicts a finite mass to clusters. Unfortunately, real clusters don't look that big. None of them actually converge. Basically, to get that, you need the outer layers to be extremely rarefied, such that if I add more and more mass, they're so rarefied that it just makes it a very, very big cluster. But we don't observe that. So let's see what Newton's constant looks like to establish such a fit. So there's, looks a lot like the galaxy one, doesn't it? Essentially, because M has grown, M not has to have to grow accordingly.
And because R has scaled much larger, R not has grown accordingly. But when you take a look at that picture, you really say to yourself, sure, it's a different M not, sure, it's a different R not, but it's a very similar G. And that's what's doing the work. So coming back to the solar system, we had the data for the Pioneer anomaly. So here, sorry about the colors, there were two different satellites, and the original data set wasn't very well analyzed because they didn't know that the anomaly was permanent. And so this is the actual data. The thing on the vertical axis is just the actual difference in accelerations. And so if there were no Pioneer anomaly, there should be zero everywhere. There should be no anomalous acceleration. So there is no anomalous acceleration at one AU, thank heaven. Right? Inside the solar system, for Earth, all the inner planets, there really is no Pioneer anomaly, which implies that Newton's constant is Newton's constant for the inner planets. However, something is turning on here. It's just like a halo effect in galaxies, where as you travel out from the center, you're in the Newtonian core. As soon as you hit Jupiter, remember, Jupiter's got 1% of the mass of the sun, so it's a sizable object. And basically, we have a extremely low chi-squared fit to all of the data. So I can invert this and say, what is Newton's constant in the solar system? Looks a lot the same, doesn't it? It's just a phase transition. You have behavior. Actually, sorry, this I subtract off one. So here is zero effect. If you add back one, you get basically Newton's constant. There's a phase transition beyond Saturn. And then after way outside the solar system, you're back to the 1 over r squared law. Except, unfortunately, I cut off the units there. And this value basically is let's see if I can read it off my own screen yet. It's Newton's constant divided by the actual value times 10 to the minus 4. And so this value at 10 means there's a deviation between Newton's constant and the renormalized value to within 1 part in 10 to the 4. So that's all we need to explain the Pioneer anomaly with a good fit. So I'm going to pan out now to a larger distance and show you the halo in the solar system. So some of us look at that and we see a particle resonance, that it's as if there's something in the solar system which is not mass, it's not dark matter, it's created dynamically, but it's as if there's some halo, some eggshell in the solar system which starts at this distance, ends here, is fully symmetrical, and it's just a very, well, I could say it's a thin eggshell, but actually it's almost 100 AUs, but nevertheless. That is one possibility to explain the Pioneer anomaly. It's the only gravitational solution to the Pioneer anomaly, and for that reason, John is on the NASA committee for this problem. Alrighty. So here I'm just showing, actually that's the same thing for G, except here, because M is a little different, it's sort of reaches the asymptote from above. And here I'm looking at a very large cluster, bullet cluster. And there's our fit to the bullet cluster. And so you could say, well, the black and the red curve match to within the error bar, but what does that mean in terms of the actual system? Well, in order to show you that, I have to show you why MOG is useful for the system. So here are the standard gravitational lensing equations you can find in Peacock. Essentially, just to go through this very quickly, sigma is the surface mass density. So we're just integrating rho, the actual density, across the line of sight. And kappa is related to the gravitational lensing. So you have these distance to the lens, the distance to the source, distance to the lens and source. Basically, you're just integrating over the density, and you get the surface mass density, sigma over sigma critical. You'll notice that inside the integral, you have Newton's constant. So we have to generalize this. We have to turn on modified gravity. And now we replace Newton's constant with this function of R. And here's the result. Extremely similar. except because we have an integral including g, I have a weighted surface mass density, where instead of the surface mass density just being the integral over rho, we have this weight function. And the weight function here, basically, you can treat as 1 plus dark matter. Okay. So hopefully that brings me to my conclusions. The closer we get to understanding the data, the more likely it seems that the dark matter question may resolve dynamically. I do say may be resolved dynamically with extra gravity. Dominant non-baryonic dark matter is dynamically generated, so it seems, by gravitational degrees of freedom. So the key here is dark matter is predicted by Newtonian gravity. But if you drop the assumption of using dark matter, then the alternative of modified gravity can lead to a very successful phenomenology. Once you have a phenomenology, you can say to yourself, am I seeing genuine physics? So it's the halo that doesn't go away. Is the halo due to dark matter? Or is the halo due to the fact that the Phylon field, these extra degrees of freedom due to non-symmetric gravity, are actually leading to a gravitational dynamic dark matter halo? So implications to further work is, of course, CNB and the emergence of dark energy. If you wanted more information on this material, you can have a look at our papers. The titles are pretty much evident in terms of what we're actually accomplishing. And that's the end of my talk. Thanks for coming. I'm going to post a PDF online, and I guess it will be visible on Cursor. Thank you. Questions? Yep. Yes. No. R naught and M naught
are narrow constants in the narrow calculation. No. R naught and M naught. So R naught is actually related to the coupling constant mu, and M naught is basically. You can consider it the energy in the Phylon field. And so when R naught is related to a coupling constant, basically R naught is equal to 1 over mu. And mu was the mass of the S1 field. So as you have a different system, larger and larger system, you'd expect there to be a certain scaling between the amount of correlations within the system to the actual momentum scales with which you're doing your experiment. And there's a cutoff prescription where you go from momentum scale to distances. And so it's actually quite a long route to go from u to r naught. But essentially, classically, that's their connection. And so when you have a field that has a mass, basically, even in terms of the fine pressure constant alpha, we know that alpha is not a constant as a function of experiment, right? So if you do, if you measure the fine structure constant, the charge of the electron with a particular experiment, you find that as you probe smaller and smaller scales or larger and larger momentum, the electron seems to have additional clothing, right? And so you can sort of visualize this mu as the same effect, that the reason why R naught is not a universal constant is because it measures the amount of clothing in the mu field. And so what is this halo? One interpretation is just like the fine structure constant with the electron. Basically, there's a renormalization here, and these fields gain clothing. And we're probing that just by living in a galaxy.
Yeah. But it would be nice to actually be able to predict the right RG flow for that. Yeah. How much of it could be available to you?
Well, I'm actually forming the opinion I'll get finished before my dissertation, which we do this. So hopefully this will be my subject in my next talk, is to actually forget all the data. The research is done, right? I'm not going to look at any more data, but to actually connect this to a fundamental theory. So right now, I would say it's 90% theory and there's 10% phenomenology. And we would like to remove that phenomenology, where we're actually using data to put back into the theory. Ultimately, we would like to make complete parameter-free predictions. And by looking at systems in different scales, you can actually do this, because when you look at a system with just one scale, for example, if we only ever did experiments, terrestrial experiments, we would basically just like to find terrestrial constant. I guess I'm going to change this to position of mark here. So we'd always be in this regime, near the fixed point, right? And when you want to probe here, you have to do either extremely high energy experiments, extremely small distance experiments, or if you believe in RG flow at astrophysical scales, then you just have to get beyond your computer. So it's quite a nice connection now that to measure these things, we just have to do experiments that are just a little bit far removed.
I have a question about NGT. Do you know the current status about the stability of NGT? And
It's been stabilized ever since the mass term was taken in. When you set the mass to the C1 equal to 0 post, and by turning the mass back on, that solves the first problem. And there are other calculations for stability. Stability is a very wide term, because there are many measures of stability. GLOST is one. You want in GR, when a star forms, it not to be extinguished in 2 weeks, right? And so there's a variety of calculations. There's no calculation which shows that NGT, according to the Lagrangian I showed today, is unstable. So in terms of stellar formation, that's extremely nice. There's not much of a difference except for some singularity resolution issues. But I would say that the status of the stability of NGT is completely cool. But there's not that many solutions that are known. And so it could be that somebody's going to find a solution that we don't yet have today. That the same thing would be true in GR, that we have a stable solution. However, in GR, you have things like the Hamiltonians, the Hamiltonians, the low, these people, so on. There are reasons to believe that GR is stable. And in NGT, there are also reasons to believe it's stable. But the arguments are quite long. It's a deep work, but it's been studied for 30 years now, and so it's not as if it's a theory like Mon, which was basically scotch tape for the insert. NGT is in class of its own. It's the only generalization of GR, right, in group theory context. So it doesn't modify the onset Hilbert action by adding in F of R terms, which do lead to basically after every F of R term is unstable. And in terms of the RG flow, you say, well, that's an ingredient you don't need. Why have that? Well, we have a non-abelian quantum field theory. And when you study the basic properties of non-abelian quantum field theories, a couple of constants are it's a proof. And so our insistence that means constant is the value we've measured, and it will remain the same value at every scale, contradicts current research in classical geometry that every non-abelian gauge theory has been proved.
So kind of more last one. Yes. You know the picture, I don't remember exactly where it is, where you have like this galaxy and you have the dark matter over here and the like baryonic matter over here. And well, that's big. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what is engineer? What do you have to say?
Well, I don't think I showed this today, but I might as well. We submitted a paper to the Royal Astronomical Society on the Bullet Cluster, because in November of last year, there was a press release from NASA saying that the Bullet Cluster has evidence of the existence of dark matter. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote our paper to the Royal Astronomical Society, and essentially there is a dislocation between the gas and the peak of gravity, but to calculate the lensing, you have to integrate over Newton's constant. And so by having the value of Newton's constant, which looks like a wave function, you can imagine that having that inside an integral acts just like a wave function. It's sort of a cartoon of what's happening in the Bullet Cluster. It's basically you're integrating. Let me do the Newtonian case first. If all you had was Newton's constant, and you're integrating over rho, like that, then the maximum of rho corresponds to the maximum of the sigma. Okay? However, Is the maximum row now the maximum of sigma? No. Because if that's a weight function, and let's say I'm, okay, so I have to multiply two functions, right? So here's my weight, and let's say my row has a nice peak. After I multiply the two together, so here's g, here's rho, and here's g times rho, the weight function is going to swash this to the right. So what log does is, in one cluster, because you're integrating this way, log necessarily dislocates the two peaks. And so our prediction for the bullet cluster, which I showed in that picture, it was unavoidable to get this dislocation. And so you could say, well, what about in the future? Because in the future, in dark matter, the two peaks are forever separated. The dark matter and the gas are dislocated in space, and they're actually moving apart. And so forever, from now on, as long as we look at the bullet cluster, we will see a lensing map and an optical map which are distinct. And it's going to get worse and worse. But in modified gravity, as time continues to carry on, this g function will continue to be renormalized. And when they're infinitely far apart, this will look like 1. And basically, in an infinite time later, the two peaks will merge back together. So we can't watch the bullet cluster because we don't live that long. But it turns out that there are other clusters that are already later stages that have been mergers and are beyond. So we will have a distinct prediction for those systems.
Yes?
Yeah, so what is there in the bullet cluster that causes this peak to be dislocated in your theory?
There is only one thing that controls this theory.
Yeah, but that's not a dynamical thing, right? That's just something out of dynamical thing. Oh, I see, because there's skewon is some
yes.
value.
Yeah. So right now we have a single function for every system. And when you look at the actual value for g from system to system without asking question parameters, you just look at the function with the g on the vertical axis and r on the horizontal axis, they look very similar, where g is slowly rising and then reaches a phase transition. So this object here is dynamical. Anything else? Yes?
Just for your comment that kind of for dark matter you would have kind of luminous matter and dark matter be kind of going on more and more separated. Well,
right, yeah,
I would assume kind of the dark matter like cluster which you have now in the middle because it sticks together. Well, first it may separate into two clusters and secondly then the luminous matter will fall back into the gravitational wave of the dark matter?
Unfortunately not.
Or is it too fast?
Yes, these systems are moving very fast. The velocity of the bullet in the bullet cluster is 6,000 kilometers per second.
But that sucks because then you have like
the
clusters which are stripped off their dark matter background.
No, dark matter doesn't get stripped. Dark matter pretty much interacts with almost nothing, including itself.
Yeah, but I mean, the luminous matter is stripped off.
Well, the luminous matter is not stripped off. Only, so the galaxies are not stripped off. Okay. The galaxies will remain with dark matter forever. The only thing that's stripped off is the hydrogen gas, the cluster gas, the X-ray gas. And so, if you were to live in these galaxies, and survive a merger, basically the dynamics within the galaxy would change due to the fact that gas has been swept off. That is a fact. The gas has been swept away from the galaxies. Similar to the gases.
Do those galaxies or like those clusters where the gas is stripped off, do they exist? I mean, those mergers do happen, so
yeah.
You would expect to see some of those clusters with the gas stripped off?
Well, no. We have never found, it's hard to say, because I could say we have never found a ball of cluster gas with no galaxies.
Yeah, or the other way around, galaxies with hot gas.
But that would be seen then.
No, we won't find that either. But nevertheless, the bullet cluster, even, whether you believe in dark matter or not, the galaxies and the gas, no, actually, The thing about that plot with the bullet cluster where they show the gas and the pink and the purple as distinct things, that's really a press release. And when you look at the data, you see that the difference between the peak of the gas and the distribution where the dark matter has its peak, you see that, in fact, the gas is quite an extended object, almost 3 megaparsecs, whereas the galaxies each are about 20 kiloparsecs apart, so 3 orders of magnitude. So in fact, the gas has not been stripped off. The gas has just been shifted.
Okay.
Okay.
Presumably the gas gets regenerated by supernovas.
Oh, I don't think so. If you integrate the total amount of gas, you get orders of magnitude above the total integration of the galactic matter. And so, unfortunately, galaxies are a speck of dust in the eyes of the gas. And if you believe in dark matter, you'll say the same thing about dark matter, that gas is a speck, right? And so, unfortunately, if you do believe in dark matter, you simply can't see anything beyond it. You just, every system, basically I'm asked, well, how many parameters do you have? And in fact, for all of my rotation curves, the dark matter fits have 3 parameters for each rotation curve. They have to put in a 3-dimensional density profile with 3 independent parameters. And in fact, while we've been doing this, the dark matter side of physics has been extremely silent because they have tremendous problems on their own. They can't explain their own observations because their density calculations don't match any known profiles. And for example, there's the cusp problem in galaxies. I mean, there's just a list of so many problems that dark matter physicists have that the question of whether or not we're going to ever observe in the lab is a secondary question. We still don't even know how to correctly describe our observations with dark matter. So having an alternative, especially one that's based on theoretical physics, gives people an alternative. And if it allows astronomers to actually do measurements that they could not have done with another theory of gravity, then the usefulness to
actual astronomers is remarkable. So hopefully people will pick up this technology, not just in terms of fitting data, because Mond did that. It was a phenomenology. And people said, oh, great, look, Mond explains galaxies, but it didn't illuminate anything. But nevertheless, when you have a theory with extra gravitational degrees of freedom, you might be able to solve a whole host of problems. And so that's why I phrased NGT in the Palatini formalism, where you've got a connection and a tetrad, and you can do a split, and you can quantize the theory. And what are those 6 extra degrees of freedom going to be used for? Because if they can be eaten so that you get back GR at the end, then you might actually have an actual renormalizable theory. But there's just so many possibilities for a rich theory. But in terms of the actual job it's doing for the data, it's the most successful phenomenology for describing galaxy rotation curves and clusters of galaxies. Mond is no longer a candidate. And dark matter also has its own problems just fitting. So it is an excellent phenomenology. It's based on well-established physics developed for over 30 years. So I'm optimistic that it will be picked up by other researchers.
The question that Kumon has something to do with the quite extremely
well. The mass?
The phion and the J.
Oh, the J is just the source. So
and where are the phions?
You know what? We should bring Moffat in and get Moffat to do a talk just on NGT. Because he's the one to answer these questions of what the J is. I mean, I know these things based on the calculations I've done, but they're 10 years old, and I'd be really sketchy. So if you want a good job done on these degrees of freedom.
Where are they? Like, how do you interpret them?
What in particular?
Do you want to show them? The phi, like the phi, what is it? It's just some other field that you add? Or do you derive it from?
Is it related to the schema? The particle, I think actually, as I said, it would have been nice if they stopped with the Einstein-Hilbert extension. And so there are these extra things that which are just there for consistency. So the mathematical constructs. And so you have, at the end of the day, you take a look at your Lagrangian and say, how many particles do I have? So I have a skewer for mass, and I have a finite mass massless. It's a vector particle. And so these particles exist in the Lagrangian simply for consistency.
So this phylum is something which could be measured according to the distribution. So it's an extra particle which could be measured.
Right, and so if you want to take its vacuum expectation value, it corresponds to something like mirror. But you have to believe this theory to do the data. Unfortunately, when you do general relativity, even pure GR, we don't use pure GR in galaxies. I mean, it would be nice if we had the metric for a galaxy. But we don't even have the metric for the solar system when we need Jupiter. Right? For the solar system, what do we use? We start with Schwarzschild, we might add rotation. We add angular momentum. But the solar system is not strictly symmetric. Right? There are planets. So we ignore the planets. But Jupiter has 1% of the mass of the sun. So how do we deal with it? We go back into this theory, and we treat it like a perturbation, et cetera, et cetera. But we never calculate the metric in GR for the actual system we're working with. So, in principle, we can measure the actual plan, but we don't even have a metric to describe the system.
We've gone quite a bit over time.
So yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.